My name is Irene Kurka and I welcome you to my podcast Neue Musik Leben. This is a German podcast, but once in a while, or even now more often, I have English episodes for you. And yeah, a little bit about myself. I have studied classical singing at a university, but I'm singing contemporary and experimental music a lot, and I really love it. If you would like to listen to my singing or meet me, please look at my website www.irenekurka.de. I will put this link for you in the show notes. And if you would like to know what I'm planning or where I'm singing or what will happen in future podcast episodes, I welcome you to come to my website and you can subscribe for my newsletter. In this podcast, I talk about all kinds of topics all around contemporary and experimental music. I share with you behind the scenes, insider knowledge, and I bring you the human beings out of the new music world so much closer. I thank you all for all your feedbacks, emails, and responses. And I want to let you know this really motivates me to keep going with this podcast. I'm cooperating with the NMZ Neue Musikzeitung, which is a great German music paper. And go ahead and check it out. I also will put the link into the show notes. Today, I have a very inspiring and fantastic interview with Ryan Dahoney. Ryan Dahoney is a professor at Beenan School of Music, Northwestern University in Chicago. He's a musicologist, an author, and a singer. And I really enjoyed talking to him. And now I hope that you also will enjoy our interview. Hello, Ryan. Ryan Dahoney. I'm welcoming you into my apartment in Düsseldorf.
It is lovely to be here.
It's so great that you're here. We will talk later on why you are in Düsseldorf. But first, I would like to know from you, how did you find your way into new and experimental music?
Oh, that's, I think, one of my favorite questions to think about. I was thinking about it a little bit, knowing that it would probably be a question on the walk from the tram. And I think my earliest experiences with new music or modernist music came in my first year of undergraduate. I took a music history class that was a kind of broad overview, but sort of arrived very powerfully at Schoenberg and Pierrot Lunaire. And I remember hearing Pierrot Lunaire for the first time as an 18-year-old and wondering what the heck that was. And I think for me, it was an awakening, something that I knew almost immediately that I wanted to spend a lot of time thinking about and experiencing and performing. And there were other pieces that came. That semester two violin phase by Steve Reich was a very important piece back then for me as a kind of experience. And I think that for me was what was so interesting about the new music I was exposed to, was precisely that sense of powerful presence that the music would give me, and bewilderment, at least initially on my part. So it all goes down to Professor Honey McConey, who taught Pierrot Lunaire to me.
Right, and that was at Rice University?
Yeah, Rice University, back in
1997.
In Houston, yeah.
Well, since I studied in Dallas, Texas, Southern Methodist University, I have been to Houston. What represents good new music for you?
I think for me it's still that sense of charged presence, of music that can bring about a real sense of uncertainty with kind of powerful emotional experience. There's a lot of new music I like. I don't think of myself as someone who's terribly dogmatic about what I think new music is or should be. But for me, I think it has to have some quality of intensity, and especially a kind of social intensity to it, that really does the work of bringing people together through a very kind of charged experience of music making and listening too. So I have my favorites, obviously, but I think I just want, new music to take me into a kind of mental space that I might, mental and emotional space that I can't get to on my own. Great. And if it does that, then it's good new music.
You're a singer and you're a musicologist. So I would like to know from you, what are the qualities you most appreciate in performers and composers you work with?
Oh, that's a nice question. I think the qualities I most appreciate are generosity, both of kind of conception of a piece and kind of emotional or sort of intellectual generosity. I think those are the things that both as a performer, which I am not as active as I used to be in singing, but even in my sort of musicological work too, I'm sort of drawn to a kind of generosity of emotion and focus. I think that's another, a sort of intensity of focus and attention. Those are the things that I find myself really drawn to, and that I think is something that cuts across all the different sorts of genres that I give time to, that there's a kind of a generosity of attention, a generosity of emotion that I really respond to.
You're a studied singer. Does this change your perspective as a musicologist and writer, and how do you combine your professions?
That's a nice one. I should probably stop saying how nice every question is, but they're nice questions.
Thank you.
For me, I think early on, I mean, as a singer, it was difficult because I wasn't actually getting to do the kind of music I wanted to be doing early on. I was trained as in a conservatory setting as an operatic baritone, and I knew upon arrival almost immediately that I had no desire to be an opera singer, despite the amazing teaching that was happening at Rice. I knew that it was not for me, and after my experiences early on with new music, I knew very, very quickly that that's what I wanted to be doing as a singer. And so I was able to work here and there with composers that were colleagues of mine. I was able to work with some newer music that I was kind of able to encourage people to work on. So I got to do some work by Arvo Pärt that I was really fond of my senior year. And I got to be a soloist in his St. John Passion, which was really terrific. I think the larger thing that being a singer, at least, or being a sort of practice musician, the way that it sort of gets into my work is that I'm really concerned with performance. I'm concerned with performance events as historical events. And I know the kind of force of performance and its power to be meaningful and to be emotional and to affect a sort of profound change in people as they're listening and thinking. So I think that in many ways is what has kind of carried over, this real sense that I want to be thinking about performance as something that has left traces in time, that I can go back and like dig through archives and try to find traces of these performances and thoughts and intentions and effects. So for me, I think it's kept that focus, or singing or being a singer has kept that focus on the reality of performance as something that I have a hard time abstracting from people and specific times and places that I care very much about trying to think about all of those things together.
Yeah, you're here in Düsseldorf visiting the Klangraum, which is an event a week or more weeks that Antoine Beuger makes possible, where musicians from all over the world come and they present, rehearse pieces. They are together, they spend time with each other, they have great talks, they mentor each other, and yeah, this is already the third time you're here in Düsseldorf, being part of this event, also participating actually. You also have given twice a talk or a talk that then led to a discussion, which was always very, very nice. This is why I'm very lucky that I can interview you in person, live, in my living room. And so how did this happen? I mean, why are you here? How did you get to Wandelweiser? And what is your experience here?
Oh, goodness. This is a really fun story. Or at least one I enjoy thinking about and telling. I, for a long time, had been kind of split in terms of my thinking about music making and musicological writing. For a long time in graduate school, I found myself drawn intellectually and emotionally to my colleagues in ethnomusicology, sort of the anthropology of music, and took classes in ethnomusicology, even though I was being trained as a historian, mostly. And I knew sort of always that I sort of wanted to change my way of working. And I think after finishing at least the majority of my work on Morton Feldman, which has been occupying me for 13 years now, a very long time, I knew I wanted to change my working method and I wanted to move more into ethnomusicology. And that means participant observation in a sort of old-fashioned anthropological sense. And Wandelweiser kind of came somewhat serendipitously. I had a friend, my friend Eric Wubbles, this terrific composer, was visiting Chicago and playing some concerts and staying with me and sort of mentioned, oh, I think you would really like Wandelweiser. And I did a little investigation. I hadn't heard the term before. And I did a little Googling, as one does these days, and found that, you know, I saw the roster of composers, I saw people who had been previously affiliated with it, and realized that, oh, my friend Kunzu Shim used to be part of Wandelweiser. And so Kunzu and I had gotten to know each other several years prior when he and his partner Gerhard Stäbler had come to New York City and stayed with me and my partner for a day and had a really nice brunch, and we walked around Brooklyn, and so... it was a good time to get to know Kunzu and Gerhard and to start getting to know their music. And I love their music very much and was very drawn to Kunzu's music and wanted to start learning it as a singer and have been working on his music off and on since then. So it was a nice little connection to my personal history that I had known Kunzu, and that though he's no longer affiliated with them, there's still a shared kind of aesthetic style that I think opened me up to Antoine's music, Jörg Frey's music, Stefan Zitt's music, Eva Maria Huben's music. So it was there was a lot of sympathetic resonance that brought me to Wandelweiser. And a lot of the aspects that I've mentioned before, these kind of sense of emotional generosity and intensity of attention, those are things that I found almost immediately with Wandelweiser. And I knew I wanted to start thinking with them, not so much about them. I came away from my first Klangraum in 2017, uncertain if I wanted to write about Wandelweiser or simply be a part of them. and right now I'm sort of in the mindset that I will hopefully be both, do both. Be
a I part think of you them. Can do both.
Yes. I'm already apparently bringing people into Wandelweiser through my talks about them. So and Antoine even said the other day that I am basically part of the furniture now. Yeah. Klangraum. So that's how I got to it.
Okay. And how was your experience then there?
I think the first week was really, I mean, I'm working on an article that sort of articulates my sort of, shall we say, initiation into Wandelweiser.
You mean the first week now in 2017?
In 2017, yeah. The first week was very... I think interesting. I mean, people were so warm. Again, there seems to be a kind of quality of person that is attracted to the music and attracted to the community that I was immediately made to feel welcome and to feel a part of it. And that's, I mean, a lot of that credit goes to Antoine for how he structures things and how he structures very carefully the sorts of people that come together and the kind of work that's getting put on. And it does have a lot to do with the kind of music that is happening. I think a piece that week that was kind of, I mean, foundational for how I came to understand the group was a piece by Stefan Tut that called Along, that was participatory, that I gradually started participating in over the week, and it really forged through this musical performance many of the relationships. I mean, it got us into a baseline of communication and affection through listening that then spilled over into now me, you know, considering Stefan one of my favorite humans.
Yeah, and you're here the third time.
Yeah, I can't stay away, so.
What fascinates you about Wandelweise, and why is it important to also write about them?
I think the sense of fascination, it was actually something that last night, Mariana, Schuppe, Stefan, and I were talking about the kind of quality of presence that the performances make possible. So there is, as much as it is about music, capital M, music, which I realize in German doesn't really make any sense, but because it's always capitalized.
Right.
But in English it matters. I think what was so interesting to Mariana and me that I sort of reiterated was this sense that, again, there's this kind of quality of action, quality of performance, quality of person that is being drawn to this community. That, again, that's partially Antoine, that's partially whomever else kind of finds Wandelweiser on the internet or, you know, studies with Michael Pizarro at CalArts. Or, you know, there's these ways in which pedagogy is central to it, teaching and mentorship, and something that might begin as like a Google search for, you know, quiet music, then might lead to a trip to Neufelden for composers meet composers that Antoine has sort of organized, or it might end up with, you know, a musicologist just like crashing the Klangraum and being like, hey, mind if I hang out? So I think that kind of quality of attachment and even friendship. I mean, for me, why it's important to write about it is because for me, all of my work is really kind of working out problems in my biography. So all my work to some degree is autobiographical. And for me right now, as I sort of get into middle age, I think I'm thinking a lot about friendship. I'm thinking a lot about sort of those kinds of relationships that will sustain me into old age, because I don't have a lot of family that's close to me. I don't have children, you know. So I'm really thinking about how people can forge friendships and lasting friendships, and what seems to be happening here at Klangraum, and with the sort of, as I started referring to it yesterday to Johnny Chang, the expanded Wandelweiser universe, which is sort of this idea of all these kinds of, you know, tenuous or extended connections and friendships that seem to be what Wandelweiser is now. These questions about friendship, it allows me to think about, writing about Wandelweiser at least allows me to think about these questions of musicianship and friendship and what they have to do with each other. And I haven't ever found a community like Wandelweiser where those two things are so intertwined. I think it might be the case that you can, it's something I write about with Morton Feldman in the 1950s in New York City. You might have had this kind of, you know, dense network of friendship that was deeply...
Yeah, that would actually have been my next question.
Oh, okay, sorry. We can sort of...
You're good. Great. Yeah, because you already mentioned it. You have been writing many books about Morton Feldman, and why you're so interested in him, and what is your force there?
Sure. I mean, I think for me, I mean, many of the kinds of questions, I mean, I realize that as a musicologist, I have a certain set of interests and questions that I'm basically working out through different historical scenarios. But I think my experience with Feldman was very much like my experience with Schoenberg early on in college. I think my junior year of college, I had the amazing composer and professor Anthony Brandt at Rice, who was my theory teacher, and he gave us an assignment for, I think it was, must have been theory 5. Junior year, where he gave us a piece that we had no idea what it was, and we had to do an analysis of it of some kind. And I just remember hearing that piece and having never heard anything like it. And he didn't tell us what the piece was until the end of the semester, and it was Piece for Four Pianos from 1957 by Morton Feldman. And by that time, we had already studied other pieces by Feldman, Durations 2 and Y Patterns and Coptic Light, so I had gotten a lot of Feldman and had become very intrigued by this sound world. And that was it. I knew also that he was connected to the abstract expressionist painters, and I, going to college in Houston, I spent an enormous amount of time at the Rothko Chapel, which is there, and I knew that Feldman had written a piece for it.
You're writing a book about it.
It's finished. It is finished.
Oh.
It is out on October 14th.
Cool.
So yeah, so I wrote a book about, kind of coming back to this idea of friendship, I wrote about the relationship between Feldman, Mark Rothko, and their patrons, Jean and Dominique de Menil, two very important French Catholic patrons who settled in Houston and tried to remake it in their modernist image and used Rothko and Feldman to help them out with that project. So for me, that sort of question about friendship started with Feldman, trying to find a way to talk about the relationships between artists across medium or media, and to see that these kinds of connections are really grounded in something very basic and very emotional, these friendship ties. And the book tries to figure that out. Though the relationships are more complicated. They're complicated by money, so that becomes a very interesting thing to talk about. And complicated by religion, which becomes another very interesting thing to have to deal with. So for me, that was sort of what I had always been somewhat of an interdisciplinary thinker, and Feldman speaks so much of music, he speaks about his music very much in terms of painting all the time, so it was a natural way to kind of think about these relationships between music and painting, but to think about them very intensely and specifically in terms of intimate relationships between artists.
Now I have a few more personal questions for you.
Yeah, sure.
What is your approach to time management, and do you have any advice for the rest of us?
Oh, time management. Okay, this is something that I deal with my students, or have to deal with my students quite a bit, my PhD students especially. It's one of the most difficult things. I mean, I'm a full-time professor. I teach musicology. My time management comes in whenever, you know, I'm teaching a full load of classes during the course of the year and I want to get writing done. What I tell my students often is a somewhat capitalistic maxim of pay yourself first, which means basically do your writing first.
Get
up early in the morning. I oftentimes will get up by 6, start to write for an hour by 7, write from 7 to 8, and then go about my day. I think one of the biggest misconceptions about writing, especially academic writing, is that you have to block off large chunks of time. And what I found, and how I wrote my book, basically, was in little snippets of time over long stretches. But you realize if you commit half an hour of writing today, if you commit to writing half an hour a day, by the end of the week, you will have had 7 or 8 pages already done. Cool. By the end of a month, that's a whole article, you know? So there, you've drafted a whole article by the end of the month if you keep that going.
So do you have a sabbatical sometimes? Or?
I was lucky that my third year I got an external fellowship that allowed me to have a total sabbatical. And I've had certain quarters off from teaching. I'm planning to apply for a number of fellowships this year that will hopefully give me a sabbatical next year.
Keep my fingers crossed.
Thanks.
But I think this is a great advice you give us. And as I mentioned before, I studied at Dallas, Texas. And when I got there, and I mean, you know how university life in the US is. I had so many classes. You have also not just music classes. I had things about whatever Greek anthology or I don't know what. And exploring stones and crazy things. And it was so much for me at first. And I thought, like, I'm never gonna get through this. And the thing was, you always had tests also and things because you collect your credits throughout the whole time. And in Germany, there was always like a big exam after a year, after 2 years, so you could just hang out and make sure somehow that you pass the exam. And so I was like, I'm never gonna do this. And then I thought all these American students, they handled it. So I thought, okay, if they can handle it, I have to handle it too.
Certainly a German can handle it.
Hopefully.
Sorry.
And then I also started doing what you said, that I really put little like snippets, and I also had to write many papers, and my English was awful back then, so it was a huge challenge. And I would also then just say, okay, I write 30 minutes every day, and then eventually a whatever 10-page paper was ready and finished. So I really also believe in that, but I still think it takes a lot of discipline. I mean, to get up early.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm happy that I'm sort of naturally early to bed, early to rise. But I think it's one of the trickiest things to kind of, because I mean, the institution I work at, Northwestern University, is a very intense school. Intense in terms of scheduling. The music major itself has the most credits of any major at the university, which was similarly at Rice. I had more classes, more credit hours than any rational human being should have to endure in a semester. But I think now I'm really focused on writing pedagogy, like really figuring out how to encourage students to become fluid writers and actually just to know how to write in order to think. I think for me, that's how I work. I don't know what I think until I write it down, until I've worked it out. So I'm very bad about describing projects to people until I've actually started writing them, because I don't know what it is.
Yes.
And so I try to get students to really, I describe it as kind of depathologize writing, because there's so much stress around writing, especially among graduate students, and so much sort of emotional stress that comes about from feeling like you're a bad writer or feeling like you don't have time, or like, so I try to kind of get my students to detach a little bit emotionally from it and just be like, well, you have half an hour. This is the time you write every day, you know?
Sounds great. Yeah. I think that's a plan.
Yeah.
What are you thankful for today?
Oh, I think I'm thankful for you. I'm thankful for my friends in Düsseldorf. I'm thankful that I get to spend so much time here. I was sort of talking about, I mean, one of the interesting things, this is probably too personal, but one of the things I feel a lot about being a professor is that the job is very intense and very stressful, and consumes, I think, a lot of emotional energy and intellectual energy, such that I don't really feel like I have a sense of self outside of being a professor. But actually, just when I come to Düsseldorf, it's one of the few times where I feel like I'm just Ryan. And I can be myself, I can be a musician, I can be a thinker, but I'm not your teacher, or I'm not your colleague, and I'm among friends. And
yes.
I'm incredibly grateful for that.
And who or what has played the greatest role in shaping you and what inspires you?
That's tough. I mean, there's so many people. I mean, it goes back to people like Honey McConey, my freshman year musicology professor, Anthony Brandt, I mean, Walter Bailey, these professors, these kind of fundamental college professors who really believed in me and saw something in me. I think other people too, like other colleagues. I think people like Tamara Levitz and Bridget Cohen, these kinds of amazing scholars who I've been just so inspired by, who have taught me how to be a better thinker, to be an ethical thinker. There's been a lot of lessons. A lot of people. I owe a lot to a lot of people. It's hard to narrow it down too much.
What does it mean for you to be true to yourself or authentic in the music business? And how do you keep true to yourself?
That's the hard thing, right? I mean, I think I've just come through a period of intense review. In the States, we have a process for professors that you are hired as an assistant professor, and you have to go through a long process of review and sort of publication and teaching evaluation that lead to a what's called tenure review. And so at the beginning of my sixth year, I had to submit a dossier which had everything in it. all my writing, all my teaching evaluation, all my courses. And then it goes off to be judged by other professors at other institutions and my colleagues and my administrators. Happily, I passed. Happily, I've been promoted to associate professor, which I will start officially next month in September. And I think part of that is there's a real risk of the sense that you have to, that you have to conform to other people's expectation of what is A, good work, B, good teaching, C, good ideas. And I think for me, I tried to do well in all those aspects. And I think for me, it was really, you know, jumping through all the hoops, you know, finishing the book, publishing the articles, getting good teaching evaluations. But I think at the core of it was really, I just wanted to kind of keep a sense of joy and fun and, you know, deep emotional commitment to the work. I think those, trying to keep a sort of light sensibility about it and really enjoying the real privilege of what it is to be a professor at a major, you know, research university in an amazing school of music. It's those kinds of things that I wanted to identify what I cared about, and I want to keep focusing on that. And I think I've been able to do that. So these questions of friendship, of community, of intense musicality and intense musical experience, I've just kind of tried to make everything relate to that somehow. So that for me is sort of the goal. Also just being nice, like being a kind person. I think as long as I'm a kind person, I'm happy about that. That for me is being true to myself, is being kind as much as I can be.
And what does success mean for you?
Getting tenure at a major research university, I think. Publishing
You're on
a book.
Your way.
Publishing a book. No, I mean, obviously doing things that are fulfilling emotionally, intellectually. I think that's the deeper level of success. They're the sort of, you know, epiphenomenon of success, which is like financial security and like job security and having a stable position. Like those are all fantastic, having books, you know, that are published by good presses and all these kinds of things that I've been really fortunate to have. So it's both the sort of those things that the world values as success, and those things, the more kind of intimate things that I value as success. You know, seeing a student flourish, seeing a student get a job. Like I've been lucky to see my student Kirsten Curthers, who's an amazing musicologist. I want to put in a plug for her. She is starting as an assistant professor at the University of Louisville this fall.
Super.
And is doing amazing work on experimental music.
Great.
So seeing my students flourish, I think that for me is probably the best marker of me doing some measure of good in the world.
And what drives you forward? Do you have a vision?
Right now I'm trying not to have any vision. I'm really tired. So I've been trying not to have any ideas on this trip to Düsseldorf. I'm just trying to enjoy the moment. I think the vision is just to stay kind and stay curious. I don't, beyond that, I'm fairly open to where things lead. But
we are actually at the last question. Which tip would you like to give young artists?
Make good friends and be nice to them.
Ryan,
I think that's fairly, yeah, that's, I'll be succinct.
Ryan, I thank you very much that this happened here in Düsseldorf.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
And I hope to see you around soon again. And
no doubt.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This was the interview with Ryan Dehoney. I really hope that it inspired you. And I welcome you to write me your ideas, your suggestions, your feedback. Thank you very much that you tuned in with me today. I hope that you liked it and it inspired you. And it would make me very, very happy if you could take some time to give me and this podcast a good evaluation on iTunes. And please recommend this podcast to all your friends. Thank you very much. I wish you all the best. Live your music, live your life, and I see you next time. Yours, Irene.